Has it ever felt like you're doing everything right? You're eating healthy, you're working out, and yet your energy still crashes, or your mood swings hit out of nowhere, like a twist in a crime story that you didn't see coming. Listen, I've been there too, and what I've discovered is that many of these issues could be tied to hormonal imbalances, like a hidden criminal lurking in the background, throwing everything off track. But here's the good news. This is one mystery that you can solve with Happy Mammoth. There's no need for a long investigation. Just take the free 2-minute quiz from Happy Mammoth. You answer a few questions about what you're experiencing and where you're at in life, and you'll uncover the real culprit behind your hormonal symptoms. And the best part? After taking the quiz, you'll get a personalized recommendation to help you balance your hormones so you can finally feel like yourself again. According to a survey, after taking Hormone Harmony, 86% of women started to lose weight. 77% said that it improved their mood. And the biggest benefit? 100% of women surveyed said they're feeling like themselves again. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code ATTWG at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code ATTWG for 15% off today. Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's revolutionizing how we deal with life's challenges, from sleepless nights to stress-filled days. Mood.com has created an entire line of functional gummies that target specific health concerns with 100% federally legal THC blends that they'll deliver discreetly right to your doorstep. And you can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code ATTWG. It is wild how different each one of their gummies feels. Their sleepy time gummies knock me out in about 15 minutes flat with no hangovers, no grogginess, and I just wake up feeling amazing. Oh, and the Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for those days when nothing's going right and you just need to hit the reset button on your crap mood. What makes these different is how they pair THC and other cannabinoids with herbs and adaptogens. You're not going to just find gummies like this in a dispensary, or anywhere for that matter. And they have gummies for literally everything. Immune support, menopause relief, PMS symptoms, mental clarity, and sexual arousal. And each one is crafted using federally legal cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no BS, and they can ship to most states in the U.S. Best of all, not only does Mood stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code ATTWG. So head to Mood.com, browse their amazing selection of functional gummies, and find the perfect gummy for whatever you're dealing with. And remember to use promo code ATTWG at checkout to save 20% on your first order. We sleep better when we sleep cool. As the weather is getting warmer, staying cool while we sleep will be top of mind. Organic and natural bedding sleeps cooler than cheaper synthetic alternatives, and they last longer too. A fresh season calls for a fresh start, and that includes your bed. From seriously soft organic cotton sheets to breathable silk and luxurious down duvets, Avocado Green's bedding makes it easy to reset your space sustainably. Perfect for hot sleepers in warmer months, Avocado Green sheets and duvet inserts are naturally breathable and help regulate temperature, so you sleep cool, dry, and comfortable all night long. Avocado bedding is thoughtfully designed and expertly crafted for lasting durability. From reinforced stitching to premium long staple organic fibers, every detail is made to stand the test of time, wash after wash, season after season. We sleep better when we sleep cool, so head to avocadomattress.com today to save 10% on all bedding and 50% on clearance bedding. Avocado, dream of better.
Darkcast Network. The light shines brightest on our indie podcasts.
How many missing persons cases have we covered, especially the older ones, where we've just thought, if only they had some sort of GPS monitor on them? In the case of a person who vanishes without a trace, it's only natural to wish for some magical tool that could just tell you where they were. But as we learn with the case of missing Houston, Texas teenager Alexander A.J. Silva, sometimes even that's not enough. AJ had been arrested in early 2021 and was required to wear an ankle monitor while he awaited trial. It was while he was wearing that device and being monitored by the Harris County court system that he disappeared and met what witnesses say was a terrible fate. How does this happen? How could a county just lose someone when they had the ability to track his exact location? We'll delve into that and how AJ Silva's family is fighting for justice. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of AJ Silva. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again. This story is another listener request.
Oh, okay.
Yes, it comes from Sasha B on Facebook. So I believe she had actually reached out to us and requested this before, but like I have ADHD and I'm terrible at things and people request things on like every single channel that we have and I have no actual way of keeping track of them. But this time, she made sure to use emotional blackmail.
Oh.
Yes. So it totally worked.
Intriguing.
Mm-hmm. On a side note, if anyone has suggestions for a better way for us to collect case suggestions, like I'm all ears. I mean, yeah, I should probably just start a Google Doc, but I haven't. So I don't know. We are on Galas, which we've talked about a little bit before, and you can find the link in our show notes. So you can comment on each episode directly from whatever podcast app you're on. So it kind of centralizes the conversation as opposed to like some people are on Facebook, some people comment on Instagram, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Please like check that out because it's all in one place and it might help me keep track of the conversation a little bit more. But enough about that. We have actually had a few amazing listeners join us over on Patreon, so I would like to start out by giving a huge shout out to Megan D and Allison L. So thank you both so much for your support.
Thank you very much.
But now let's get into the story of AJ Silva. Alexander Silva III was born on December 10th, 2001 in Baytown, Texas to Concepcion and Jock Rendell. He was quickly adopted by Concepcion's brother, Alexander Silva Jr., and his wife, Betty. Concepcion, who goes by Connie, said that she knew she wouldn't be able to care for a baby. She wasn't working, and AJ's father, who was Creole, was on the road a lot playing in a Zydeco band and wasn't ready to settle down and start a family.
What is a Zydeco band?
You don't know what a Zydeco band is? That's
no.
Like the Creole, like Louisiana music. So if you want a very like white version of it, it's like the band that's always in the Popeyes commercials.
Okay.
You didn't even, I was like trying to like give you something you would understand.
Yeah. I mean, I know the jingle. I didn't realize that was like a whole genre of music that I didn't know about.
I mean, Popeye jingles is not, to be fair, a whole genre of music, but Zydeco for sure is. So he, the father, is Black and Creole, and Connie is Mexican, so AJ is biracial. Jock is off in his Zydeco band, and Connie wanted what was best for her son, and the burden of the decisions, as they so often do, fell to her, the mother. She didn't know what to do because she knew her limitations, but she didn't just want to give him up to strangers either. Unfortunately, the answer to her problems came in the form of her aunt and uncle. Her uncle Alexander and his wife Betty wanted to take AJ. Betty had children from a previous marriage, but she and Big AJ, as they call him, had not been able to have any children together. and they wanted a child of their own, so baby AJ really became a gift to them. Little Alexander was known by the nickname of Baby AJ in the family, and then he grew into Little AJ. Before being called just AJ by like people outside of the family, though people inside of his family definitely still called him Little AJ. So Big AJ, Little AJ. Big AJ and Betty raised Little AJ as their own, but still kept his parents involved in his life. I mean, they were family after all. This had the extra benefit of AJ at least always knowing where he came from. Now, Betty's granddaughter, Adriana, was close in age to AJ, because remember, Betty had previous children and they were adults. So they are much, much older than AJ. So it's really like their children who are his age.
Got it.
Yeah. So it was Betty's granddaughter who basically kind of grew up as almost more of AJ's sibling. The strong familial connections were important as AJ experienced a good deal of loss in his early life, including his mother, Betty, when he was just around 9 years old. Unfortunately, Big AJ, after Betty's death, fell into an opioid addiction. After this, Connie tried to get her son back, Little AJ, and while he did end up staying with her for a time, Connie was still dealing with her own struggles, so the reunification wasn't permanent. This is when I'm going to take a moment and introduce Paul Vasquez to you. Paul is known as Uncle Paul. He is Little AJ's uncle. He is Connie's brother, and he runs the Justice for Lil AJ account on TikTok. He has been the one who has been leading the charge to get his nephew's disappearance investigated and to get publicity for him. He's also very open about both his struggles and those of his family. He's a recovering addict, and he says that addiction unfortunately ran rampant in his family, which is something that Little AJ had to grow up around. In fact, Paul says that his addiction is the reason that he couldn't step up and take AJ himself, even though he had thought about doing exactly that many times. He just wasn't in the position to do so. Because of all of this turmoil, it won't come as a huge surprise that AJ started acting out. What I did find slightly surprising is how young it started. Now, remember, his mom, Betty, died when he was around 9. Connie says that by the time he was 11 or 12, he was not only starting to ask her some hard questions like, why did you give me up? Why didn't you love me? That type of thing. But he also started running around on the streets and experimenting with drugs.
At 12?
Yeah, 11 or 12 is what Connie said.
And that was when he was with Connie.
He was kind of going back and forth at that point, it sounds like.
Okay.
Connie even said that he would stay in motels with sex workers and other, like, I imagine adults, but, you know, she didn't say specifically the ages or anything, but either way, I mean,
somebody had to be an adult to get the room.
You would think, but, you know, I don't know. That just sounds like a very bad situation.
For sure.
Clearly.
Yeah.
Things only got worse for AJ. From what Connie says, sometime between the age of 13 and 15, her son was sexually assaulted. She doesn't seem to know the details of this, but obviously it only harmed his mental health further. After a while, and after he continued to run away and made it clear he didn't want to stay with either Connie or Big AJ, Connie says that she sent him to Louisiana to live with his biological father. AJ stayed there for about 2 years and apparently did well in school during this time, but he continued to get in trouble and eventually asked Connie to come and get him. As I intellectually know, despite my best personal efforts, changing locations doesn't mean that all of your problems go away. Upon his return to Houston, AJ attended high school, but he was arrested for an unknown offense. Because the offense took place in Harris County, which is where Houston is, he had to remain there. Connie lived in a neighboring county, so AJ stayed with his grandmother. Connie would still go and drive him back and forth to school, but eventually AJ, who was given an electronic ankle monitor, ripped it off and ran away. He eventually ended up back in jail and never ended up officially graduating high school. Now, I'm getting a lot of this information from an interview that Uncle Paul did with Connie, where they just basically talked about their whole family history and, you know, everything leading up to AJ's disappearance and his actual disappearance. And so I want to say how much, like, I adore Uncle Paul. Throughout his entire interview with Connie, you can tell that this is a guy who has been through some 12-step programs and some therapy. He speaks in that way that, like, recovering addicts often do. I can't really describe it, but if you've ever known or been close to a recovering addict, like, they just all have a very similar way of talking, I feel like.
It's the therapy and the common speech.
Right.
You know, I'm not saying in a dismissive way. You learn that your behaviors are not unique.
Yeah.
And so, yes, there's a lot of common phrases and a lot of common, just general commonalities amongst addicts or anybody that really goes to therapy or whatever.
You know, just as an example, he transitions into talking about AJ's relationships. He was apparently involved in several very volatile, toxic relationships with a lot of fighting on both sides. Paul is sure to interject that AJ was modeling toxic relationships that he had seen in his own life, because after Betty's death, he wasn't really exposed to any positive ones. It's very much therapy talk, and, you know, I'm here for it. I love it. He's correct. It's also incredibly important because when we have stories of missing people who were engaged in risky behavior prior to their disappearances, they have a tendency to get written off. People say, well, what do you expect? But Paul is sure to humanize his nephew at every turn, which is what we're aiming to do here as well.
Right.
The issue of relationships is important, as the relationship that AJ was in at the time of his disappearance could have possibly played a role in what happened to him. Now, in this interview, Paul only uses AJ's girlfriend's first name. And since I don't think it's been in any news articles, I'll do the same, though I totally know her full name from her criminal record. But regardless, he met this woman, Joni, we're talking about AJ here, in 2020, when he would have been 18.
And how old was she?
12 years older. So about 30.
Okay.
And she was also married.
Oh.
Though apparently separated, though that seems to be a little iffy, but apparently separated and already had, I believe, 2 children. Major red flags here, mainly just because of the age thing and the possibly just being married thing as well.
Yeah.
Listen, I was a single mom. I do think people should date single moms. I don't know that teenagers should necessarily.
Well, yeah. I mean, I didn't want to talk about my experience, but, you know, the age difference is not a huge deal when the younger is also an adult.
Yeah. And though he was legally an adult, like, right. You 18, know, 18 get is out still of here.
A teenager.
Yeah, yeah. 12 years. Absolutely not. Now, according to Connie, Joni didn't know how young AJ was at first, which honestly, sure, maybe I'm going to call bullshit only because I've seen pictures of this kid. He did not look older. He looked like a kid. So maybe you thought he was 21. I could somewhat buy that depending on the lighting, but, like, you didn't think he was 30. I'll tell you that much. Regardless, the relationship became serious and Joni and Connie became relatively close. Joni would text Connie and call her mom.
Creepy.
I know. Like, I know it's normal for a lot of people, but, like you and I are married. We have a whole child together. We've been married for several years, and I absolutely adore your parents, but, like, I'm not calling them mom and dad.
Yeah, I don't think that I've ever called your mom and dad.
I mean, you have when you're drunk, but, well, like, that's different.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, I don't know. It's creepy to me, but that's just me. Like, I'm not saying objectively, whatever. And, like, if I'm in my 30s and dating a literal teenager, like, ugh. But it doesn't matter because in any case, AJ and Joni's relationship was volatile, as was his pattern. You know, this was not the first volatile relationship he was in. According to Connie, AJ and Joni got into a lot of verbal arguments. And this dynamic was on full display on Easter Sunday, April 4th, 2021. Connie was having an Easter party at her house, complete with a giant inflatable water slide for the children. Now, I don't know if AJ and Joni came with her kids, but Connie says that the couple was already arguing as they pulled up. It was the type of argument where they stayed in the car for a while after they parked.
Lovely.
Yeah, well, you know, one of those. But once they joined the gathering, things seemed fine. They hung out, they ate, they took pictures, like totally normal stuff. The next day, April 5th, AJ had a court date. Now, this had nothing to do with like those charges I was talking about earlier, because those were, you know, a few years before. This was a whole new ball game, one that was directly related to Joni. In January of 2021, AJ was arrested for felony retaliation.
What the hell does that mean?
I had no idea. I'd never heard of that before.
Neither have I.
Yeah. So I looked it up. And according to the Fulghum Law Firm, under Texas law, retaliation is similar to obstruction of justice, which is like, that's a charge a lot more people have heard of, I would think. The difference is, quote, where obstruction occurs before a public servant or witness does something, retaliation occurs afterward. Retaliation is the act of harming someone or threatening to harm them for having given testimony, reported a crime, or acting as a public servant, end quote.
Okay, so it's felony threats, essentially.
Yeah.
Okay. That I understand.
Okay, yeah. So I think it's just like it's called that in Texas.
Yeah, it's just a different wording.
Right. According to court records, AJ was indicted on January 27th, 2021. The document states in part that AJ, quote, on or about January 12th, 2021, did then and there unlawfully, intentionally, and knowingly harm and threaten to harm Joni by an unlawful act, namely assault, in retaliation for and on account of the service and status of Joni as a person who the defendant knows intends to report the occurrence of a crime, end quote.
So domestic abuse?
I mean, basically, but related to she was going to turn him in for something. According to the original police report, quote, defendant was arguing with her and had been gone all night. Defendant left and went into her vehicle. Complaining witness, aka Joni, wanted him out of her vehicle. Defendant went back in. More arguing. She says she will call police. If he, and I think I'm quoting, they said he, but I think they mean she, got the police involved, he would have his other baby mama beat her up, end quote.
Wait, he has kids?
Not that I've seen at all. So I have no idea what that means.
Okay.
That was very confusing to me because, like, Paul has never mentioned him having kids. Nobody, Connie, like, I've never seen anything else about that. But it was basically like they were fighting. He went into her car. She said, get out. And he threatened her. She called the cops, blah, blah, blah. So this was all part of the probable cause finding. It also stated that the defendant was not present due to mental illness. It also granted Joni an emergency protective order. The court further found that probable cause did exist for further detention. This was when AJ was once again given an ankle monitor. And he had this ankle monitor at the Easter party because all of this happened in January of 2021 and Easter was in April of 2021. Now, I don't know the exact terms of this, but he wasn't on house arrest. And this is where a lot of confusion comes in. He was not on house arrest. This is a pre-trial ankle monitor. He has not been convicted of anything. This is basically a condition of his bond. So instead of sitting in jail awaiting trial, he was let out, but he had to wear this electronic monitoring device.
Right. And I'm sure there were certain parameters as far as like times of day that he needed to be home.
Exactly. Like he had a curfew.
Yeah.
There are certain places he couldn't go.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's stuff like that, but it's not house arrest.
Right.
So, which is why he was able to go to Connie's Easter party, you know, because presumably that's within his zone of things that are okay. It was during the day.
Right.
You know, now at this time of his life, he also may have been living with Joni, which I'm not exactly sure about because she did have the emergency protection order against him as well. But regardless of where he was staying. I know he wasn't staying with Connie, but she said that she would hear from him regularly, at least once a week. So when she didn't hear from him for over a week after that Easter party, she contacted both him and Joni, you know, like just to check in and make sure everything was okay. But Connie didn't get a response.
Not even from Joni?
No, from neither of them. Not until April 22nd. So now we're talking like 2.5 weeks after the party when she said she spoke with her son at least weekly, if not more. So on April 22nd, Joni called Connie's partner at 5:30 in the morning. She told him that she had just gotten out of jail.
For what?
Well, according to her, she got pulled over by the cops. Her wheel fell off. She went to jail and CPS picked her kids up from school. AG was mad at her about this and she didn't know where he was.
But why was she in jail?
I don't know. Her wheel fell off.
You don't get arrested for a vehicle.
I don't know. But that, according to Connie, that's the story that she gave. Her wheel fell off. She went to jail. CPS got her kids and AJ was pissed
and
took off.
And she was gone. She was in jail for 2 weeks.
Well, I don't know when she went to jail. I don't know when she said she went to jail, but she got out on April 22nd.
Okay.
And that does check out. Like, she definitely did get out on April 22nd. She was in jail. Like,
probably not for a charge of wheel falling off.
Yeah, that is accurate. Because according to court records, Joni was arrested on April 21st, 2021 for gun possession and possession of between 4 and 200 grams of meth.
Slightly different than getting pulled over and my wheel fell off. So
I mean, a wheel could have fallen off during all of this, to be fair. But yeah, it was mainly the gun and the meth.
Yeah, it's weird how she left that out of the story.
Yeah. The judge set a $2,500 bond, which it seems like she posted with the help of a bail bondsman, from just what I could gather from the records.
Okay, but that arrest happened on the 21st.
Yep.
So there's still a whole lot of unaccounted time for.
Correct. Where Connie was trying to get a hold of her and AJ, and neither one got back to her. Just for those of you who don't know how bail bondsmen work, if you're released on a money bond, you can either pay that amount, in this case $2,500, to the courts and get out of jail while you await trial. And provided that you show up to all of your hearings and trials, you know, whatever happens, the money is returned to you once your case is finished. Another option is to use a bail bondsman. You pay that person a percentage, usually 10% of the bond, and they put the rest of the money up to the court. Now, if you do what you're supposed to do, the bail bondsman gets all of the money back, but they keep the 10% or whatever the percentage you agreed on as their fee. So basically, it's a tax on the poor, because if you're rich, you can get all of your money back, but if you can't afford it, you lose 10%. So that's a whole other situation that we won't get into right now. But in any case, Joni had her first court appearance on April 22nd. She had several other court dates that kept getting continued because she kept showing up without counsel. Finally, on May 17th, she signed a pauper's oath and was given a public defender.
I'm sorry, wait. A pauper's oath?
Yeah, it's not necessarily called a pauper's oath, but this is common in a lot of different jurisdictions. And that's basically how you get a public defender. You have to prove that you can't afford a private attorney before a public defender will get assigned to you. That's why, you know, the Miranda rights, they say, you know, if you can't afford an attorney, one will be appointed to you. They don't want like random rich people like taking taxpayer attorney time.
I've just never heard it referred to as a pauper's oath.
Yeah, that might be a Texas thing. I don't know. I don't think that that is what it's called like universally, but in researching many different cases, like something like this is very common. Usually there's a hearing, there are like forms you have to fill out. And sometimes that's also how bail amounts are determined. So especially in cases like California, so, gosh, I'm getting off on a tangent. This episode's already long, so I apologize. But in the Kristen Smart murder trial, Paul and Ruben Flores, when he was let out on bail, he actually got his bail reduced from what was initially granted because he filled out like all of this financial paperwork. And so they lowered it to something that he could afford.
Yeah.
So with Joni, she went through this and she was given a public defender. In August, she was granted pretrial courtesy supervision. I'm not sure if that means she also had an ankle monitor, but I do know she had to show up for regular drug tests. Now, I only know this because in October, she violated her bond by trying to falsify her test results. She apparently showed up to her drug test with a condom full of someone else's urine taped to her abdomen.
Perfect.
Yeah. Joni had to submit to drug tests twice a week after that. And in November of 2021, she pleaded guilty to the drug possession charges. I believe that the gun charge was dismissed. She was sentenced to 2 years of probation. But just about a month ago from when we're recording this in January, on December 7th, 2022. So backing up, 2 years of probation. And this is like at the end of 2021. So in December of 2022, after about a year, she was granted an early termination of community supervision.
Why?
Good behavior, apparently, despite the fact that she had taped a condom full of somebody else's urine to her abdomen.
Doesn't sound like good behavior to me.
I would agree, but yes. Yeah, so she only ended up having to be on probation for a year instead of two, did not serve any jail time for a gun and meth possession charges.
Right, but the gun charges were dismissed.
Apparently, so yeah.
It's just possession of meth.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean to...
Right. No, I'm saying, but like from what she was initially charged with to what it ended up being.
Right.
So getting back to April 22nd of 2021, this is the first time that AJ's family really knows that something is wrong because, you know, Joni's just getting back to them and she's like, I don't know. AJ's pissed off at me. I don't know where he is.
BT Dubs, I've been in jail.
Right. And nobody knows where AJ is. More time passes. Connie ends up at some point going to Joni's apartment and confronting her and obviously didn't get anywhere. And so on May 6th, Connie filed a missing persons report with Houston PD.
So this is a month after anybody has really seen him.
Yeah, basically to the day. And so this is the part that's going to be confusing for people. Because to a reasonable person, the chain of events would be missing persons report is filed with Houston PD. They go to Harris County, which is the county that Houston is in, just to be clear, and say, hey, one of your guys who you're monitoring is missing. Can you like go pull up where he is so we can go grab him? Then they would pull up the logs, cops go there, they find him, end of story. It seems like a very simple chain of events to me. Like if somebody goes missing and they're wearing an electronic monitoring device, you would think, yay, this is going to be easy.
One would think.
Right, but obviously we would not be doing this episode if things were easy. Because none of that happened. There was a lot of jurisdictional back and forth between the Houston PD and the Harris County Sheriff's Department, which, you know, again, is asinine because Houston is in Harris County. Yeah, we're not even talking like different...
Right, it's called concurrent jurisdiction. Like...
Right.
They operate in the same space at the same time. It's yeah. Where we live, it's the same as Leesburg PD and Loudoun County Sheriffs.
Yeah, exactly.
It's concurrent jurisdiction. They back each other up. They all do the same job, enforce the same laws. Just one is city versus county.
You know, as we know, like, and I think that a lot of people who live in similar jurisdictions have had experience with this. Sometime there is some friction, and it appears that there was a little bit of friction here. But regardless of the friction and the jurisdictional blah, 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 what quickly became apparent is that no one had actually been monitoring AJ's electronic monitoring device.
Perfect.
Now, based on movies and TV shows, like, one would think that if you violated the rules of your ankle monitor, whether it was staying out too late or going out of the area to which you've been confined, an alert goes off, like, you're swarmed by cops 5 minutes later. But that's not the case in many jurisdictions, if any, including Harris County. Instead, what happened in this case was Pretrial Services, the agency in charge of keeping track of all this, told reporters for Fox 26 that when they noticed that AJ was seemingly not where he was supposed to be, that they called him just to, you know, say, hey, buddy, what's going on? He did not answer.
So weird.
But no one did any follow-up beyond that.
So they never reported it to PD?
No.
Brilliant.
Thankfully, after months of bureaucratic struggle, AJ's family was finally able to acquire his ankle monitor logs. According to these logs, AJ had not been where he was supposed to be for quite some time, and no one in charge took any action beyond that single phone call. According to AJ's mother, Connie, the records show that the monitor, quote, was tampered with on the 14th of April, but then it goes completely off on the 15th, comes back on the 16th, and then it shows he's at a warehouse for 41 hours, end quote.
Okay, so a week after the Easter party, he or someone starts tampering with his ankle monitor.
Yeah.
And then the next day it goes blank. And then the day after that it comes back online, but it's shown at a warehouse for 41 hours.
So the end of that 41 hours was April 17th, 2021. And after that day, AJ's ankle monitor was powered off and never came back on.
So did anybody go and investigate the warehouse?
AJ's family did.
Why wasn't local police, why weren't they involved?
Well, that's the crux of this entire episode and the question that we're really trying to answer here, and we're not going to answer. So by the time they found all of this out, you know, the 41 hours, et cetera, AJ's family already knew something was terribly wrong. And 41 hours in a seedy warehouse only confirmed their fears. But police, to your question, they said that AJ probably removed the ankle monitor and took off.
Okay. I mean, go and confirm that.
Well, exactly. Because
like, it doesn't even have to be a fucking detective. Like, go send a black and white and look for the damn ankle monitor.
It's not an insane theory, right? I mean,
No, it's a perfectly reasonable theory on law enforcement because, yeah,
sure. The last time he had an ankle monitor, he took it off and ran.
Sure. But so, like, the weird thing about ankle monitors is it's a GPS device.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you can say, oh, it's at a warehouse. We'll never find it because it's a big warehouse.
It's also not that big of a warehouse from the one picture I've seen, but still, regardless.
It's a GPS device.
Like, yeah.
You'll find it.
Well, and it was powered off, so you couldn't use the GPS to find it. But you still could physically
You could go to the location, yes.
Right.
The last known ping or whatever.
They could have very easily done that. But instead, they're like, oh, no, he ran away, which, again, like I said, is fine. But you don't have evidence to back that up other than his prior act several years before.
Just confirm it. And it,
yeah, you just got to confirm it one way or another.
Just send a patrol unit out to look for it.
But they did not. So enter Uncle Paul. Now, Paul grew up in Texas, but currently lives in New Mexico, like 800 miles away. He decided to drive up and investigate himself. He joined Connie and some other family members and searched through bayous, trap houses. They went into some very dangerous places. And they went to some of these dangerous places that they had known he had frequented, you know, places where he and his friends partied, things like that. But they turned up nothing. Then they went to Lumberton, which is the neighborhood where that warehouse was located. They couldn't search the warehouse. you know, the warehouse is private property. They couldn't just go in and, you know, look around, right? Because they're not police. But they went to the neighborhood, and while they didn't find AJ, they did find some answers. All right, so the rest of this whole account and episode is only going to scratch the surface of what AJ's family has been going through. One of the reasons that it's taken me so long to write this and why I've been working on it forever is because it's such a rat's nest, and I had trouble making my way through it in a coherent way. I've written enough of these episodes that like I can kind of get through them and get to the point kind of quickly, but this is just one where I just really had a hard time. Uncle Paul has done an amazing job of chronicling his struggle to find AJ and get justice for him. So I don't feel like I need to reinvent the wheel. If you want to, which I hope you do, get all the nitty-gritty details and more information and theories on who's involved, you should really just follow him on TikTok at JusticeForLilAJ. And we'll have that link, of course, everywhere. But here's the gist of it. Paul was very easily able to find a witness who lives in Lumberton who said that AJ was murdered near that warehouse where his ankle monitor stayed for 41 hours. Connie told Fox 26 about what the witness said, saying, quote, "She said she saw a young man matching my son's description running through these little containers they have out there. A dark-skinned person was running after him with a gun, and when they got to the fence, he shot him in the head and the stomach," end quote.
That's pretty specific for a witness.
Yeah. According to Paul, quote, "He bled to death against the fence across from an AA meeting covered in garbage bags," end quote. He also said that people took pictures with his body. Now, I don't know if Paul has actually seen these alleged photos. I don't think he has. But either way, I can't imagine how horrific that would be to hear about a family member. Now, this does seem like a pretty crazy story. But Paul says that when he went to the section of fence that the witness had pointed out, he saw blood. He later had somebody bring a cadaver dog to the scene, and that dog hit on the scent of human decomposition. Paul even took a sample of what he thought was blood on the fence and got it tested at an independent lab. Not only was it in fact blood, but DNA testing shows that it belonged to his nephew. So here's what we have. Ankle monitor logs showing that AJ and or his monitor were at this warehouse in Lumberton for 41 hours, including April 17th. A witness says that AJ was shot and left in front of the fence near that warehouse on or about April 17th. DNA evidence that links AJ to the fence. And like, I'm just a realtor, but it seems to me that this should be enough evidence to warrant an actual police investigation.
More than enough.
I mean, maybe AJ did manage to remove the monitor and run off. Sure, but there's a lot more evidence pointing in the opposite direction.
Right.
However, Houston police seemingly do not agree. In fact, if you look up AJ, you can see that he is currently charged with a GPS violation and a few other minor charges. Those were eventually dismissed, but he still has an active case against him for the $5,000 bond that he was out on at the time of his presumed murder.
And they're just not going to investigate the possibility that he was murdered?
Yeah, no, they're like, oh, he ran off, so we're going to charge him with skipping out on his bond.
Even though it was proven that there was blood, his blood, found at the warehouse where his ankle monitor was last pinged.
Yeah.
Why?
I mean, that's a $1 million question. So you have all that, you know, the blood, the cadaver dogs, et cetera. But what about the witness who says that she saw AJ's murder? Like, you have her too.
Right.
Houston police told reporters that she changed her story and wasn't credible. And this is a claim that Paul very much disagrees with. In a meeting that Connie had with Houston PD in July of 2022, this is what an officer told Connie. Now, I'm quoting from recorded audio, that I believe Connie took. I'm not exactly sure, but it's recorded audio from this meeting. It's kind of hard to understand, or else I would just play it here. Paul put this in a TikTok, and so I'm going to post that on our blog so you can hear all of the audio. The officer says, quote, "We're still talking about the same witness, right? The one that was discredited? So that means, do you know what that means? That she was discredited? That means that everything she said was a lie. So therefore, if somebody says something that's a lie, then it's not followed up because it was never true to begin with," end quote. And like, I need you all to please watch that video because I'm not really doing justice to her condescending tone that she had toward the mother of this teenager who is definitely missing and probably murdered.
I don't understand how the witness was discredited.
Houston PD is saying that she changed her story. Paul says she did not. So I don't have much to go on beyond that.
I mean, okay, fine. Let's get rid of the witness.
Okay, yes, I agree. But before we get rid of the witness, which we still can, because there's enough other shit.
That was my point.
I know that's your point. So, but before, I just do need to mention something that Paul mentions in that video, which is this is a city. Houston is a large city. There's a lot of crime. Apparently, this neighborhood of Lumberton is not a great neighborhood, right? This witness lives there. You don't snitch in a neighborhood like that. And you certainly don't randomly make shit up like that. Like, she put her life in danger to say anything. So why would she put herself in danger to just make up some bullshit story about some kid that by all accounts she did not know?
Yeah, none of it makes sense.
It doesn't make any sense. But you're right. Let's throw away the witness. Let's just say whatever, she's crazy, she made it up.
Sure.
Who cares? You still have corroborating evidence.
Yes, you have DNA evidence that at least he was bleeding.
If you're tearing off your ankle monitor and you're running off to start a new life or whatever, you're not going to sit in front of a fence and bleed. Like, that's not part of that plan.
For 41 hours.
But again, the DNA. Yes, this is not admissible DNA.
Sure, but that's... there's a difference between evidence in court versus...
evidence that lets you have an investigation.
Yes.
Exactly. There
is probable cause, not at the level of, you know,
beyond a reasonable doubt,
beyond,
right?
A reasonable doubt.
We're not convicting,
yes,
anybody with Paul's privately tested DNA, right, that he collected himself.
But there is probable cause that something happened, not necessarily a murder, although probably, but the probable cause is that something nefarious happened that needs further investigation.
Exactly.
But opening an investigation is not a legal proceeding.
Correct. And to my knowledge, Houston PD has never tried to get their own sample from the fence.
Right.
In fact, according to Paul, like, they let the owners, or, you know, I don't know that they let the owners, or the owners just did and they didn't intervene, but there's been new dirt, you know, placed around there.
So it's like, gone. It's gone.
I mean, yeah, maybe there's something, who knows? DNA is crazy, but it's definitely in a lot worse position than it was, you know, a year ago or whenever it was that Paul got this.
And it's because it was listed that he was essentially a runaway.
Yeah, he was just basically just some,
they,
you know,
probably listed him as an absconder.
Yeah.
Or a fugitive.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever.
Yeah.
But it's literally the same thing that we've seen time and time again.
Right.
They list somebody as a runaway, and then they don't have to investigate.
And I mean, at least he was like 19 and not, you know, 9 like some of the other cases.
Yeah.
But
still.
Yeah. Oh, and you'll love this. So in January of 2022, exactly 1 year ago, Houston PD told KPRC2 that AJ's case was investigated by homicide detectives who found no evidence of foul play.
Bullshit. Who said that?
Houston PD. That was their official statement to reporters.
What level, what was investigated?
Well, they didn't go into that. They just said investigated by homicide, found no evidence, and so they kicked it back to missing persons, and it's still under investigation. But yeah, let's just be for real. Like, I'm not a detective, but I spend a lot of time researching missing persons cases, and there have been very few that I have personally come across that have more evidence of foul play than this one has. You almost have to be willfully obtuse to say that there's no evidence of foul play and like say that with a straight face. So what happened to AJ at that warehouse? Paul's theory is that Joni had something to do with it. And as I said, I'm not going to get too much into all of this. I'll leave that to him. But he does say in his change.org petition, which we'll have linked, quote, "The first person I talked to saw him shot by the fence and saw someone resembling his girlfriend cover him in garbage bags, and hours later, after people were able to pose with his body and take pictures with it, take it away," end quote.
Take his body. She took his body away.
Yeah, somebody resembling her. He goes on to say that Joni's car went missing around this time as well, shortly after AJ's disappearance. I'm not exactly clear on who it was, if it was him, if it was Connie, if it was another family member, their PI, because they've hired a PI. But somebody actually found a car that matched Joni's.
Was it missing a wheel?
No, but it was the same make and model, and it did have the same damage to the rear fender that hers had. It also had sand on the floorboards. And Joni and AJ had traveled to Galveston, which has beaches, shortly before his disappearance. More disturbingly, they also saw what looked like bloodstains inside of the car. Now, they alerted Houston PD about what they had found, but I don't know exactly what happened there. The end result is that they never followed up, and from what I understand, the car is gone now. But even if Joni was somehow involved, it doesn't sound like she was alone in this. Remember, if we're not throwing away that witness statement, that witness did say that a, quote, dark-skinned person was running after AJ, and that does not match Joni's description.
I don't know what Joni's build is, but any, look, I've done, you know, body drags, and it's not easy to pick up dead weight.
Okay, we're going to need to pause right here and remind people, because we have a lot of new listeners, that you're a police officer.
Yes, I am law enforcement, and it was...
Because you flat out just said, out of context, I've done body drags.
Okay, okay. Dummies that are weighted for, you know, 180 pounds or whatever. Like, that's...
Right, you're talking about trainings.
Yes,
that
yes,
you have taken,
yes, I have,
to further clarify, yes, your statements.
I'm sorry. No, I have not picked up... I have not physically picked up a dead body and carried it, no, as part of my training, but we do body drags.
Right.
And pick them up.
Yes, so...
Point being, that is physically difficult for people that are in shape and work out and train for this. Because dead weight is very difficult to pick up and carry.
I mean, if you look at it from just like a general statistical standpoint, typically, if an intimate partner murders their intimate partner, it's not a situation where they're in a warehouse for 41 hours and then chased through a street and then shot against a fence where people take pictures and then there are garbage bags and then the body is moved. Like, that's typically not how that situation happens.
Right.
The manner of death indicates to me that either the intimate partner was not involved at all, or that there were several people involved.
Yeah, and everybody was out of their minds on meth.
I mean, that's a theory. But regardless of who was potentially involved, it seems pretty clear, at least to me, that a crime did in fact occur. And Alexander A.J. Silva is no longer alive. Yes, he struggled. He made poor decisions, but he absolutely did not deserve to be murdered, have his body desecrated, and be treated like trash. The Houston Police Department has a lot to answer for here. Why have they refused to investigate this crime? Why does A.J. not matter to them? And on a larger level, Harris County also shoulders some blame here. In January of 2019, there were only 27 defendants on pretrial electronic monitoring. By October of 2021, that number had exceeded 4,000.
What?
So in a 14-month span, Harris County went from doing pretrial ankle monitors on only a very select group of cases to basically everyone. I mean, I have no idea what the total number is, but in 14 months, it went from 27 people awaiting trial to over 4,000. While I'm an advocate for keeping people out of jail while awaiting trial, you cannot implement a system like this without proper oversight.
My honest opinion there, that sounds like they contracted out their monitoring system.
They did. Now, as I mentioned earlier, Harris County pretrial monitoring is like the department in charge of all of this. But in terms of the actual ankle monitors themselves, that is done by private companies.
Right.
So, yeah, like if you go to the website, it's like you can get your ankle monitors from these three places or like whatever. So there's that. But apparently it is Harris County Pretrial Services who are in charge of the monitoring, the actual like paying attention to the logs. They did tell reporters that, and this is again in 2021, I don't know what the current numbers are, that they had 21 staff members, either full-time or part-time, assigned to this.
21 people.
Yeah. To keep track of over 4,000, full and part-time. So not even 21 full-time staff members. And I don't know what the breakdown is between full-time and part-time.
I mean, any way you cut that, that clearly is not enough.
Albert Foxconn, director of the Surveillance Technology Oversight Project, told KPRC2, quote, "People are trying to use the ankle monitors so that they aren't politically on the hook if someone commits a crime while they are awaiting their day in court." So what it sounds like to me, and again, this is just a very much a layperson's, you know, general idea of this. What it seems like to me is that Harris County is trying to save money because while they subsidize the cost of these ankle monitors, it's a lot cheaper to give that to somebody than it is to house them in jail. So if you have 4,000 people who have ankle monitors who would have ordinarily been in jail awaiting trial, that's saving the county a lot of money. The judge is free to say, hey, you don't need to be jailed while you're awaiting trial. You can be on this ankle monitor. Then they can wash their hands of it. Because as far as the judge is concerned, they're handing them off to another department who is supposed to be paying attention to them. It's not on them anymore.
Right. And I wholeheartedly agree with you that if there's a way to keep people out of jail, then do it. The problem is that you can't just hand over 4,000 people to be monitored by an agency that doesn't have the infrastructure to support that monitoring.
Interestingly, Doug Griffith, president of the Houston Police Officers Union, actually agrees that this whole thing's a bad idea. He said that, you know, the ankle monitors aren't a fix-all, which is kind of what it seems like Harris County is saying, and that judges and prosecutors are just using them to cover their backside. Like I said, I mean, they can just push it off to another agency and say, like, I did my part. This lack of oversight has not only led to people like AJ becoming victims of violent crime, but to defendants perpetrating violent crimes. A man named Dion Ledet was supposed to be under electronic monitoring, but he never reported for it. Like, he never actually went and like picked it up and got it put on, like, for months. And during this time, he killed HPD senior officer Bill Jeffrey. And this isn't even a situation where they were not monitoring his device. He had never picked it up. Another man, Jesus Gallegos, tampered with his monitor multiple times and failed to charge it repeatedly, but nobody did anything about that. And he ended up murdering his girlfriend.
I'm really trying to not go off on a tangent here about probation and parole, which, of course, you know, is near and dear to my heart.
Again, for the new listeners, Ethan comes from a law enforcement family, and his father spent 37 years as a state parole officer.
Yes, that is the easiest thing for political pundits to cut. Parole is viewed as a waste of money, or it's soft on crime, or whatever. But literally, these are the gaps that probation and parole officers fill. They are the ones that are monitoring the in-betweens, and they're getting cut, and it's basically non-existent across the United States anymore. And it's infuriating, because that is an area of law enforcement that is crucial. It's pre-trial service, it's post-incarceration, it's just all of the holes that exist for monitoring when you get into the criminal justice system and when you eventually get out. And I'm not saying it's the end-all be-all and it's the greatest thing ever, but good Lord, you cut out anybody paying attention from the time you get arrested to the time you go to jail. And then you cut out everybody from the time you get released to the time of the end of your sentence. So now if nobody's monitoring you, you just get kicked to the curb and you're just out there on the street with nobody helping you, with nothing.
It's not a part of the system that people think about that often.
Right.
And I'm talking about average citizens. Obviously,
no, nobody knows about it.
Within the system, you know, that's different. But yeah, you forget about them if you're not involved in it. But it's cases like this that really do highlight the importance of it.
Yes.
And one of Paul's big issues with his nephew's case, of which, of course, there are many issues, but one is the fact that there's been very little media coverage. This episode is different in that most of it is based on work that the family member has done, in this case, Paul. And while I have used a few articles as sources, that is not where the bulk of my research was. There just was very little. And what I would love as a citizen, not of Texas, just in general, what I would love is for a really good investigative reporter to get in and look at the budget, follow the money, because it's just my suspicion, like I mentioned, that this whole pretrial ankle monitor boom that they had between 2019 and 2021 is budgetary. It's a cost-saving measure. It's also my guess that the fact that Joni was taken off of probation a year early, despite being caught trying to cheat on her drug test,
which is a violation of probation.
I have to imagine that that was also budgetary. Joni's arrest happened after April 17th, whatever happened to AJ. So, you know, keeping her for that extra year, whatever, wouldn't have changed anything in his case. But there could be some sort of, you know, grand conspiracy, but I get more of a sense that it's sloppiness, apathy, and budget cuts that led to a lot of this. AJ has a family who loves him dearly and who continues to fight for him. But they can't do it alone. We need to help AJ's story get out there so we can force Houston PD to just do the bare minimum. Honestly, the bare minimum of an investigation, which they have refused to do for a year and a half. AJ didn't deserve his fate, but maybe his death can bring about positive change in a broken system.
Thank you.
Alexander Silva III has been missing from Houston, Texas since approximately April 17, 2021. He is a biracial male with black hair and brown eyes. He was 5'7" and approximately 140 pounds at the time of his disappearance. He was 19 when he went missing. He would be 21 today. If you have any information on the disappearance and potential homicide of AJ Silva, please contact the Black and Missing Foundation at 877-972-2634 or visit BAMFI.org. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
Be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains May 2nd through the 12th. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.